Good morning, folks. Friday, June the 5th, the day before the anniversary of the D-Day invasion on the beaches of Normandy. And it's a big celebration. I think it's 82 years ago tomorrow. I know there are going to be some festivities at the World War II Museum, as they always do, and they're always first class. I saw an interview with a couple that are 100 years old that had both participated and contributed in World War II. And it's a wonderful day to remember the bravery of so many men and women that served and the freedoms that we enjoy as a result of their efforts. We've got a great show. We're going to visit with Tommy Fauché, president of Louisiana Mid-Continent Oil and Gas Association. We'll talk about what they were able to accomplish in the most recently ended legislative session. Councilwoman Leslie Harris and Deputy Superintendent Nick Gernon join us at 11:30 to talk about the DNA lab, the positions that have been approved. We'll talk about the future of the DNA lab here in the city. Jesse Manley, Interim Executive Director of Court Watch NOLA. We'll get Jesse's take on the elimination of three judgeships on the Orleans Parish Criminal District Court. Lucy Quartz joins us, licensed clinical social worker and senior director of behavioral health at Crescent Care. We'll talk about mental illness, mental health care. The month of May was actually Mental Health Month, but we can always talk about this issue. It's a very important issue. And unfortunately, every time budgets get cut, mental health is one of the first things to go. Interesting survey that was posted just, I think, yesterday or the day before, if my memory serves me correct. An Elon University poll surveyed people about the best, what term best described how they felt when they thought about the United States marking its 250th anniversary this year. And what's interesting in this country is the marked difference as to how we view the place that we call home, the country with the greatest amount of freedoms, the country based on capitalism, the country that does not stand in the way of success, that actually encourages it, the country that allows freedoms that no other country, in the totality of the freedoms that we enjoy, there's not a single other country that enjoys as many freedoms as we do here in the United States. Maybe it's that very ignorance of that fact and the lack of experience of visiting other countries, gaining a better understanding of other countries as to what freedoms they allow, and more importantly, which ones you don't have as a citizen of that country. And maybe in our educational process, we should spend more time having our students read. We'll talk about that as well in a second. But this is telling, right? One in five, fewer than one in five Democrats feel proud to be an American ahead of the 250th birthday, compared to two in three Republicans. Just 18% of self-described Democrats say they felt proud, and only 17% felt grateful, according to the poll by Elon University. A bigger number of Democrats, 21%, said they felt conflicted about America. 15% disappointed, 6% frustrated, and nearly a quarter had no strong feelings about the country they live in at all. Now, you take that and contrast that to Republicans. 68% of Republicans said they felt proud of this country, to only 18% of Democrats. A 50% differential, a 50% delta. 19% said they felt grateful. Just 1% of Republicans felt disappointed about America. 1% felt frustrated, and 9% had no strong feelings at all. And what's interesting, you know, as I've been watching these congressional hearings and the banter back and forth as it relates to this country, what's going on in the Iranian war, and what's going on with the Ukrainian war, and the dialogue around all of this as Democrats are inquiring of Republican cabinet members on certain things, and always having to throw in there, you know, the idea and the notion about patriotism. Well, it's interesting. They might be proud of this country. Maybe it doesn't sound like it from what they're saying, because it's like they're almost pulling for the other side, especially in Iran. I mean, it's absolutely incredulous to sit there and listen to folks that are almost really cheerleading for us to lose, right? And trying to define a win. Well, obviously, none of these folks have ever studied the history of war or anything else. I've never served, so I can't look at it from that perspective, but I've read a lot. And in the midst of the battle, what you would hope to achieve is not necessarily characterized as a win one way or the other. And it's not until you look back, typically, on the situation, on the individual battles, on the characteristics that present itself while in the midst of the battle, do you recognize or realize exactly what was the defining moment, what caused this, what caused that, and a whole lot of ingredients go into this jambalaya of this. How do you define a win? And it's almost like, you know, they need that instant gratification and this embrace. And if it's not there, they're willing to use it against the country and suggest that what we're doing is not meaningful and what we're doing doesn't mean a hill of beans. And at the same time, trying to convince everybody that they're patriots. Meanwhile, we have men and women over there making huge sacrifices. They're away from their family. They're away from their kids at a very simplistic level. And they're putting their lives at risk. And we've actually lost some American lives. Now, we can argue over whether or not we should be there or not. But that's really almost of no moment at this point in time, because in my view, we're there. So if we can't be the biggest cheerleader for our country, who are we cheerleading for? And that's what I don't understand about these folks that are saying these things and polling in this way, where we have this huge delta between the way Republicans look at this country as opposed to Democrats. We all have the same rights. We have the same privileges. We're able to do the same things. We enjoy the same freedoms. Is it really all about just whether or not we control Congress or we control the presidency? Is that the narrow perspective that we have in this country? You've heard me say, and I'm not a hypocrite about this issue at all, what goes on in D.C. is not going to really move the quality of my life one degree right or left. I recognize that mostly what's going to influence the quality of my life is what the Jefferson Parish Council does, the leadership in the parish presidency, because that's the parish that I live in. And the other one is who's the mayor of New Orleans and the New Orleans City Council, because they're the economic epicenter of this region, and that's how we are identified internationally. Those two bodies are going to have much bigger impact than anything that Joe Biden ever had to say, that Barack Obama had to say, that Bill Clinton had to say, or the two Bush presidents had to say, to include Donald Trump. And if we can't recognize the positives of this country, separate and apart from the identity of certain individuals who happen to be in leadership positions, who may or not be credible leaders, that we really have a problem here in this country, and we don't really understand the basics of a country. It is bigger than any singular individual. And we're selling ourselves short. But I guess we have got to this point where we've just chosen to divide. If Republicans are going to be positive on this, then Democrats are going to be negative on that. If Democrats are going to be positive on an issue, the Republicans are going to be negative on that issue. It'll be interesting to see how we're going to break the cycle. How do we get out of that? I don't suspect that it's going to happen with political leadership. In fact, I would bet against it. I would suggest to you respectfully that it's you and I that change this, that change this mindset, that changes the culture of this country. Both things can be right. You can feel horrible about the leadership, but you can feel great about the country. Because there's a lot that's going on that's not influenced by what the folks inside the Beltway up in D.C. do on any given day. They are not the center of our country's universe. Many of them believe that they are. And what you will find is the most credible leaders up there are the ones that recognize and understand that they're not. So it's interesting, I think, that some, you know, the Democrats seem to fall prey to this kind of attractive nuisance, for lack of a better term, of what goes on inside of the Beltway. We're so much bigger than that, so much better than that. There are so many individual success stories. Yes, there's a lot of failures. There's failures in every country. We have people that have evil in their heart and evil in their mind. We get it. We're humans. We're not perfect. But the totality of this country is second to none. Yes, do we have a difficult history that some people just can't come to grips with? Some people are not willing to move on. Some people are not even readily willing to admit that things are better. Moving from being imperfect to perfect is a long and arduous, bloody trail. If you study history, you're going to find it in almost every single region of the world. And there are a lot that are still dealing with it in the same fashion that they did 250 years ago. And in many cases and in many countries, it's worse today than it was 250 years ago. I would dare say that that is not even close in this country. And if you let yourself be dragged down into the mire of that story, maybe that explains what's going on here. There was an article in a publication that pointed out that Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert on a show was challenging Trump supporters because they said Trump supporters feel like they're the rightful owners of patriotism, Christianity, bravery, and sacrifice of military, police, and firefighters. And they go on to talk about that. But, you know, the interesting thing about it is that I don't see Republicans trashing the military. I've seen the Democrats do that. I don't see the Republicans trashing police and firefighters. I don't see them trying to minimize either one of those incredibly worthy vocations. The utility of what they do in this country is enormous, very, very important for an ordered and structured society. I don't see them characterizing the Republicans. I don't see them characterizing police and firefighters, EMS, and other first responder communities as Nazis. I don't see them with this complete, total lack of understanding that they are taking an oath to enforce the laws. If the laws dictate something that they don't like, that doesn't make these bad people. Be mad at Congress. Change the laws. But that's what they're constitutionally supposed to do, is enforce the laws. They don't get to pick and choose which laws they want to enforce. So when we talk about, maybe it's not ownership, but actions speak louder than words, in my view. And Republicans don't act contrary to the best interests of these respective communities that play and have an incredible amount of utility to the safety and security of the citizens of this country. Plain and simple. Call it whatever you want. But y'all are often running, Democrats that is, on any number of these issues, mischaracterizing them, mischaracterizing the statistics. It's amazing when you see some of the videos that are presented of questions that are presented to college students about police shootings in this country and what they believe. How many people do the police shoot annually, right? On average, the numbers have not really changed a whole lot one way or the other. About 1,100 police shootings on average in this country. And you talk to, you ask the question to these folks, and they're quoting like 100,000. And predominantly, 99% of those that are shot and killed by police in this country are black. How did we get there? They're so far off what the facts are. It's mind-numbing. It's actually mysterious as to how we got to where we are. But this is the rhetoric that's put out there in order to perpetuate things. And people are sopping it up. And it's reflected in these surveys as to how they feel about this country. Do yourself a favor. Do the research. Don't believe what you see on social media. Go get on your computer, and in 10 minutes you can get the whole body of research behind it. The Washington Post posts the number of shootings and a report on that every year. Every year. Stabbing, shootings, the race, gender of the victims, so forth and so on. It's all there. But that means that you would have to be able to sit down and focus and read, right? Well, it turns out that a number of college professors and scholars are warning that students' reading skills and attention spans are abysmal. Literature professor Tyler Jake wrote in the Chronicle of Higher Education that he told of an assignment for his rhetoric and writing class that asked students to read a 20-page paper. In his class, not one student was able to finish reading the paper. It was the same length that he had assigned for 5 years. This professor had read that same paper as an undergraduate 10 years ago. When I asked why, a student answered honestly, it was too long. She kept losing track of what the paper was about. This was not a remedial class. These were students who had cleared the admissions process and had written essays good enough to get them into college. Yet, he says, a routine academic reading assignment had completely defeated them. They couldn't do it. Some Ivy League students, he says, can't finish an entire book. In fact, some students do not have enough of an attention span to finish a movie any longer. He believes that's what's causing this. Smartphones, AI, and Common Core. He says the students from districts that protected sustained reading through small class sizes, strict phone policies, and a faculty who refused to teach to the test all arrived with their attention relatively intact. He says my students from districts that surrendered to devices and standardized testing arrived cognitively winded. And we wonder why we find ourselves that we cannot separate, we cannot critically think, we cannot assess things for what they are. And it reveals itself in each and every one of these surveys. And maybe we need to go back to start teaching about this country, the importance of this, our 250th anniversary. I've actually toyed with reading on air the Federalist Papers. In fact, I printed them out the other day because I've read them about 10 times, and I said I'm going to read them again because it reminds you of what everyone was thinking about in the founding of this country. And they should make these kids in freshman year in high school read it. They should spend an entire class on it, so they understand the construct of this country and why it is. And it's amazing how closely the challenges, the deficiencies, the positive, the negatives of over 250 years ago and now. It is wild when you read through it. And maybe then and only then, if we start taking this serious, we'll be a better country for it. We'll be right back. Folks, the discussion in and around mental health, I don't know that there's any more important discussion. And it's always should be a top of mind issue for communities across this country. Lucy Quartz, licensed clinical social worker and senior director of behavioral health at Crescent Care, joins us. Lucy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Good morning.
Good morning to you as well. Lucy, obviously, May was Mental Health Awareness Month, but it's never too late to have this discussion. Let's talk about why that started and where it stands today.
Yeah, you're right about that. Yeah, the discussion needs to be ongoing. The reason why Mental Health Awareness Month started, it actually started back way back in 1949 by an organization called Mental Health America. And it was all about raising awareness around mental health as a legitimate condition that there was treatment for, and to try to get away from the sort of secretive or hiding of mental health problems, putting people into asylums and treating people as untreatable, you know, and that there was some kind of moral failing. So really moving away from that, getting education, getting information out, and getting folks the treatment that they need.
You know, we track a lot of different things. I'm not sure how closely we track mental health. Do we know or do we have estimates of how many people in Louisiana are living with a mental health or addiction condition?
Yeah, we do. The estimates in Louisiana mirror that of national estimates, and that's generally that about 1 in 5 individuals will experience a mental health condition in any given year. So in Louisiana, you know, we've got a little bit over 4 million folks living in the state. So that means a little more than 800,000 folks in the state of Louisiana with some kind of mental health condition. Could be mild, moderate, or severe, you know, like anything else. There's a continuum, but a little over 800,000 is the estimate.
What is the state of the infrastructure that we have here in the state to service that population?
Well, that's where there's some really exciting recent news, actually. So across the state, there are mental health, community mental health clinics that exist in every parish, which is fantastic. And those have been in place for years and years. What is being developed is across the nation, across the United States, are what's called certified community behavioral health centers. And that is a mental health center that is holistic, takes care of individuals from birth to death, provides all kinds of wraparound services to keep folks who have mental health conditions in care and take care of all of their needs, not just mental health, but food access, housing, things like that. And the state of Louisiana just recently was one of 10 states in the U.S. who were awarded a Medicaid demonstration to be a part of the Medicaid demonstration as a, what the acronym is, a CCBHC. So that means more sustainability for even more mental health centers above and beyond the community mental health centers that were already in place. So the idea is to get more and more providers available to folks who have conditions. You know, even in the state, even though we've got, you know, a little over 4 million folks, some of those estimates are that 3 million of those individuals don't live within a community where they actually have good access to mental health. So that's a striking number to me, you know. So this is really exciting. This is really exciting news for Louisiana and the other 10 states.
We constantly hear about shortages in, you know, the medical fields, doctors, allied health professionals, in other words, and others that all touch kind of the mental health service delivery network, right? What is the state of the state? Are we struggling there as well?
Yeah, we absolutely are there. And that's a little bit as to why, you know, that data that over 3 million folks don't live close enough to get good access to mental health care out of a total population of just about 4.5 million. I mean, that's really striking. So we do have many what they call healthcare professional shortage areas in Louisiana, like in many states, especially in rural areas. And so, yeah, the idea is to get more of these clinics in place, do more things like community-based mental health or telehealth, use that to reach folks who maybe can't commute, can't get to the clinics, and also really looking at increasing the capacity of our primary care providers. You know, to treat really common conditions that affect many individuals, like anxiety and depression. A lot of those kind of initial treatments can be done by a primary care provider. So providing them with the professional development they need to feel comfortable doing that.
You know, one of the things that I recognized after 40 years in law enforcement is that whenever, you know, we got into budgetary constraints, one of the first areas to get cut in the medical side of things was always mental health. There just didn't seem to be enough folks advocating for mental health services. I've been gone almost 9 years now. I can't imagine that's changed, right?
Yeah, that's a really great point. I think we've seen that happen for sure. What I can say is, on the optimistic side of this, is that, you know, our president has kept grant funding in place for places like CCBHCs, these community mental health clinics, to exist. And so while there are cuts, I think we're also seeing very positive things in that, you know, Health and Human Services is continuing to fund these community mental health projects and things like the Medicaid demonstrations. So, yes, I think that we're going to see nothing but, you know, more need than there are resources, right? That's absolutely true. And also, this gives me a lot of hope, seeing these kinds of projects being funded and celebrated by the government right now.
We're visiting with Lucy Kortz, licensed clinical social worker and senior director of behavioral health at Crescent Care. Lucy, I know you and others that are, you know, volunteering your time for any number of organizations have worked really hard to beat back the stigma that surrounds behavioral health. What do you see out there? Is it working? Are we gaining ground? Where do we stand?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say absolutely we're gaining ground, and absolutely stigma still exists. It's sort of shifted over time. So we're gaining ground in that, you know, we understand mental health conditions much more as being highly treatable and actually very common, right? Back to that 1 in 5 statistic. So that's the good news. We've really shifted away from thinking of folks as untreatable and sick to actually know, like, that finding a life of meaning and purpose and keeping people engaged in work and education in their communities, that is going to keep them well. So do early screening, do early intervention, get folks the treatment they need, just like we would a sprained ankle or diabetes or high blood pressure, right? Just get folks in front of the professionals they need and get them the treatments that they need, because they're very effective.
You know, what's interesting is what I found, too, in my 40 years is that those with serious mental health issues, if the mental health delivery system is intact and they're able to get their medications, they are a very compliant member of the community and society as a whole. And the moment that you disrupt that, you know, everything goes to hell in a handbasket.
So true. You know, these folks who are struggling with the most severe mental health problems, which is the estimates are more like 1 in 20 when it comes to that. So nowhere near is common. That's the minority of folks. But you're so right. You know, it can be very disabling to live with these super scary conditions that makes even just being outside around under other individuals a very scary and daunting task. And with the right medication and the right therapies and the right supports and the right community engagement, they do very well, you know, and we have a lot of organizations that support folks and families like that, you know. And again, that's another task of the community mental health centers, the CCBHCs, to serve folks who are mild and moderate in their conditions and also some of the most severe, and to really fold in folks' support networks, whether that's their pets, their families, their chosen families, because the more support, the better.
When you look at the totality of all of the mental health, the system and care, what do you see as our biggest challenge over the next 10 years?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest challenges is back to that stigma piece. It's that, that helping folks to understand that, A, if you're living with a mental health condition, it is not a personal flaw, personal failure. And if you're not someone living with a mental health challenge, but notice someone you love is, to check in on them and ask how they're doing and tell them that you're a part of their support. And maybe we can educate ourselves too on some of the local resources in our areas and some of the language that we can use to really help support folks to get them help, you know? And I think that's probably the biggest challenge given how common mental health conditions are. Folks can delay getting into treatment 5 and 10 years, you know, and they're living with great psychological distress in the meantime and not able to participate in our society. So I think that's the biggest hurdle, is just given how prevalent mental health conditions are, continuing to try to screen earlier, intervene earlier, and really normalize that this is just another condition, just like any other condition, like I said, like diabetes or high blood pressure. Let's get folks help.
You know, it's not until you sit down, like with a family member that of someone that has this a serious mental health condition or near serious mental health condition, do I think, you know, it was a real eye opener for me. I remember it, you know, during the course of my career, where you gained a much better understanding, as you just described it. When you stay afar from it, it's hard to embrace and understand what it is, right?
That's so true.
And when the bulb goes off, though, it's kind of like, wow, you know, really, I mean, this is a condition. This is not anybody's fault. This is just kind of a, you know, the wrong wires and the wrong plugs, right?
That's so true. And I think having exactly like you said, having that personal connection to someone who is living with one of these challenges is a very eye-opening experience. And I'd be willing to bet that the listeners right now, folks have somebody pretty close to them who has lived with a challenge or is currently living with a mental health challenge. And that is a very eye-opening experience to be a part of someone's support system who is struggling like that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Lucy Courts, licensed clinical social worker and senior director of behavioral health at Crescent Care. Truly appreciate your time and your insight, and have a great weekend.
Thanks so much for having me. Take care.
Thank you. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakenheart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Would it be great not to lose power during summer and hurricane season? WWL wants to make that happen for you. We've actually teamed up with Craig's Electrical and Generator to offer you the chance to win a Generac GP6500 portable generator, a nearly $1,000 value. It's happening now. Go to WWL.com/contest for your chance to win comfort, security, peace of mind from Craig's Electrical and Generators, because when the power goes off, Craig's comes on with WWL. And also, folks, if you love soccer, yeah, that's right, summertime football, join WWL and Cajun Cannon Bobby Hebert and Steve Geller next Friday at Caesars New Orleans. I've broadcast live from there several times, It's a blast. It's a lot of fun as they count down to the largest sporting event on the pitch this summer. Bring your red, white, and blue and meet Bobby and Steve Geller from 4 to 8 p.m. at Caesar Sportsbook as we kick off the big game between America and Paraguay. This 5,700 square foot sports book with 4 betting windows, 12 self-service betting kiosk, a 147-foot video screen. It's absolutely incredible. And, of course, air conditioning, the most important thing there is. There's no more comfortable way to watch the games this summer. Go USA. We got the fever at WWL. It's actually a lot of fun to go over to the sports book. There's a lot of activity going on. And of course, Bobby and Steve will always make it very interesting. They love to banter with the folks out there, so it'll make for a great environment. I've always enjoyed broadcasting live from Caesars. They are very hospitable, and they really love having folks come out and enjoy the festivities, and we always enjoy it. A lot of folks texting in about my monologue, and you know, the numbers. These numbers are what they are, folks. I mean, you can be upset about it, but it is what it is. I mean, math has no emotion. It doesn't lie. These are the responses. Elon is not a conservative university. Okay. So if you're thinking about, you know, whether or not this is a legitimate polling, it is. I mean, you know, I don't know what to tell you. I'm trying to peel back and understand why the feelings are the way they are. We're not perfect, but I think we're the best, plain and simple. And I will always cheerlead for this country. And I'm always appreciative of the freedoms and the privileges that I enjoy each and every day. And no matter who is in the presidency, I respect our country. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Equinar Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. All right, folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we're going to visit with Jesse Manley, who is the interim executive director of Court Watch NOLA. We'll talk about the bill that eliminates three judgeships, in the Criminal District Court for the Parish of Orleans and what their perspective is on the impact. And we'll also visit with Leslie Harris, New Orleans City Council woman, and Nick Gernon, Deputy Superintendent with the NOPD, about the creation of new DNA analyst positions within the NOPD Crime Lab. And we'll get an update as to where we stand with the DNA lab and the crime lab in general when we return. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Newell on WWL.